A novel about the disappearance of the Meyer of Meyer lemon fame brings up issues about agricultural explorers tasked by the U.S. Department of Agriculture to go forth and find new species. It is a fascinating subject for this nuanced novel. We speak with the author, Allison Alsop. It's on Tip of the Tongue.
Welcome to Tip of the Tongue, a podcast on the Nitty Grits Network, where we explore the intersection of food and drink and museums. This is Liz Williams.
We're here today with Allison Alsop. Her writing has won multiple contests and recognitions, including the 2014 O. Henry Prize Stories Best Food Writing 2015 and the UK's 2018 Manchester Fiction Prize shortlist. She is the co-founder of the nonprofit New Orleans Writers Workshop, where, in addition to teaching, she mentors fellow writers one-on-one to develop their stories. Foreign Seed is her first novel. Welcome, Allison.
Thanks, Liz. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I want to tell you how much I really enjoyed the book. It was so good. And I haven't actually read a novel that wasn't some kind of wild detective novel in years. I had just given up on novels. And so thank you for making me look at novels again.
I'm quite flattered with that response. I'm glad to bring you back to novel land.
You know, I really have to read so much to keep up with things professionally. And I'm reading mostly nonfiction, and I wind up reading historical information and scientific information. And there's always cookbooks, and I'm trying out new recipes from the books and all of that. And then I don't want to read about, you know, people's feelings and all that kind of stuff. I just want something to entertain me through something. And I had gotten to the point where I felt like that's what novels were. It was, you know, I couldn't read anything like Jane Austen or anything like that, because I'd read it. I mean, I would try. And after page, you know, 35 or whatever, I would just shut the book and say, "You're just too stupid to figure out what's going on in the world. I'm not reading about you. I'm not spending my time reading about you." And I just got to the point where I just couldn't do it. I couldn't. People weren't pulling me in to explore the place where that person was. It was just like, ugh. And I just thought, I don't have patience for you. Anybody like you should just stop whining, you know, all that kind of thing. And so it would just make me so angry, I couldn't read the book. So I opened your book with trepidation, because I thought, I'm going to do this, but who knows? And so I had to tell you that. Otherwise, I just read, like, you know, super graphic, horribly wild and the detective stories. So
it's like, well, Foreign Seed is a detective story of sorts.
It is. Yes.
And the novel's premise, right, is based on a true one. So there is a very true story at the center of this. But in listening to your description of novels, I will say this, that there are, in fact, quite a few emotions and feelings in this novel. And so I am very grateful that you continue to work through them. Difficult, thorny spots, matters of the heart, matters of the spirit, all of those are also contained. But perhaps what drew you in is that this is, I hope I don't sound as though I'm tooting my own horn here, but it is a deeply immersive setting. We are in China in 1918. And it is not a time or place, right? Those two, that juncture of China during that time, that is written about very much. So you probably haven't written or read a lot of that in other novels. And as a result, you may have felt as though you were learning as you were reading about a very unusual time and place.
That is true. I did feel that. But I also felt that the exploration of the feelings and emotions that were being experienced by people was not presented in a way where it wasn't real. In other words, you could sympathize with the emotions that somebody was dealing with because they were actually trying to deal with them. This vice consul was very, very full of all kinds of experiences that were obnoxious and difficult, and also dealing with his brother. And there were many things that were just coming to the surface, but he was trying to deal with them. He wasn't asking somebody else to, you know, feel sorry for him or anything like that. And I liked that. I liked that. But how did I, but, you know, I also know that this podcast is about food. And so how is it that you decided that the man for whom the Meyer lemon is named should be the almost non-character, but still a character in this book?
Yeah, he is an iconic figure. Frank Meyer was an iconic figure in real life. And he is also that in this novel. The novel began with the premise, which is a true one, that in June of 1918, Frank Meyer, who was an explorer, he was what was called an agricultural explorer. He worked for the United States Department of Agriculture in a little office called Foreign Seed and Plant Introduction. And so the title of the novel is Foreign Seed, and it is borrowed from a very small office that Meyer worked for on behalf of the American people. He traveled to China on 4 rigorous expeditions, off and on, mostly on, for 13 years. And this novel picks up in June of 1918, when Meyer has suddenly disappeared from a ferry on the Yangtze River during the course of his 4th expedition to that country. The man who is sent upriver without any clues, without any direction of what has happened to Meyer, is Vice Consul Samuel Sukobin, again, a very real individual who takes charge of the investigation. And he heads upriver with his interpreter, whose real name is lost to history. Sukobin would ultimately file with the United States government a report, which I have read in the National Archives. And that report totals about 6 double-spaced type pages. In addition to that, there are a couple of statements by witnesses, Meyer's assistant, also a man who shared the cabin on the ferry very briefly, the captain of the ferry, all of whom were interviewed in this investigation. So there was a little bit of supplementary material. But I was fascinated by this mystery, that it had been real. It wasn't because I had some kind of unfounded, unrequited love for Meyer lemons. It was the man himself and the mystery. And I had been fascinated by Meyer, but it was probably while watching the 800th murder series on Netflix that it occurred to me that this is really where these attempts that I had been trying to write about Meyer, about his expeditions. I said, no, Allison, this is where the story starts. Ironically, the story starts, and it's the very first line of the novel, with Meyer's disappearance.
And so how did you uncover or stumble upon the story of Meyer, and so that you could, you know, further extrapolate from there?
Yeah, I had been writing about, in other stories that I had been working on, other fiction about Chinese immigrants coming to the United States. I'm from the San Francisco Bay Area, and there's a very large Chinese American population. I was quite fascinated with that subject and wrote multiple stories. In the effort to understand where these immigrants might have come from, I tried to look for photographs of the era that I was writing about. And that's how I stumbled first upon Meyer's name, because during the course of these expeditions, you had an American who had gone to China and as part of his work, taken photographs. So his photographs popped up multiple times. I thought, who is this guy? What is he doing over there? So rather than Chinese coming to the United States, I was thinking of someone from the United States now going to China. And I, you know, fell, as many people did, down a Google search, learned that he had been a real person, that he had been this agricultural explorer going over to China, and that he had introduced some 2,500 species of plants to the United States, right? Many of which are still around. So I just became fascinated by the idea, who would be the kind of person who would up and leave their country, go on incredibly rigorous, right, death-defying, really, expeditions to China in the name of plants. So I became quite fascinated by Meyer as a character.
Well, I can understand that. I mean, he did really uncover so many plants that we have absorbed. Okay, so there's a lot more to the book than just the fact that it's about Meyer. Meyer just becomes the vehicle to tell the story. So how did you develop Sacobin, the vice consul?
It's a great question. So because this is historical fiction, and you know, anyone who writes historical fiction, we're all geeks, we're all nerds, absolutely self-confessed and proud of it. So there was a whole component of the investigation for Meyer, and I was able to draw on Sacobin's original report. When you write a novel, you have to think on multiple levels, one of which is, what are going to be the events? What's the plot? And so in that case, I really tried to stick to as much as I could about the factual events of the case. So Sacobin's report was really helpful for me in having, I would say, a skeleton of some of the events of the book. But a novel is more, and as you've talked about, there's also lots of feelings involved and ideas. So you can't just stick to the facts, because if you did, you might as well just be writing nonfiction or an article, right? You really have to then have a departure from fact, right? And capital truth with a T. And so this whole portion about Samuel Sacobin, again, real name, real person who was sent upriver to head this investigation. But what we don't find out from the report, we know what Sacobin did, but we don't know who he was as a person. And what I came to understand in the course of watching 800 Mysteries on Netflix was that in a modern mystery, it isn't just enough to solve the case. We really need to have a personal investment in our detective like figure. What's the stakes here? Why is this case going to be something that they will become obsessed with, become over the line? That's where we want to see our detective figure, right? What is it that they can't get over that's going to keep them up late at night, crossing a line, not being able to stick within the rules, right? And so for that portion of the novel, I had to wildly invent. And I thought, what could give Sacobin a reason to become fascinated, even obsessed with this missing explorer? And I thought, okay, well, the United States has entered into World War I. And on this portion, I 100% made up a story about Sacobin having a much younger brother that he had not seen in many years, and who, like Meyer, had a real penchant for risk, adventure, foreign travel, and who at the start of the novel, Ethan, the younger brother, has been missing for several months as a fighter pilot at the start of the American involvement, right, in World War I. I should say specifically the American involvement in air battles and flyers. They were called flyers at that time. So it is this mixing up in Sacobin's head emotionally of course, the missing brother, which is really the case, of course, that he would like to be investigating, finding his missing brother, and the conflagration of that in his mind with this other very adventurous, risking explorer of Meyer. So it's a triggering case for Sokoban every time he is looking for Meyer.
So I know that we had talked before about you reading a little bit of the book. Do you want to read to us about Meyer and Sokoban and their getting together?
Yeah. So in real life, the fact is that Sokoban and Meyer had attended an event in Peking in a consulate. Sokoban, the real Sokoban, had seen Meyer, and that was going to be useful in his search. In my book, I push it a little bit further because just seeing someone across the room isn't quite as interesting. And I also wanted to have a chance for Meyer to appear in conversation early on, and so that we could get to know who this person was, this iconic figure. So in my book, we're still early on here in the novel, and Sokoban, and just to set this up, this is the year before Meyer goes missing. They meet in Shanghai before Sokoban is promoted to vice consul in Nanking. So this is set in Shanghai at the consulate. This is right before even the United States has joined the war, but the war is already on. And it is a party for the 4th of July. And Sokoban has, by chance, encountered Meyer. Sokoban is trying to avoid, for some personal reasons, other people at this party. And he and Meyer are having their very first and really the only, right at this point, conversation. I should also mention this, that Meyer was not originally an American citizen. He was born in Amsterdam and then immigrated to the United States. The explorer's English was grammatically perfect, too much to ever be native, and Sokoban detected a faint accent, a Scandinavian precision that hardened the edges of his words. He recalled the papers mentioning something about Meyer immigrating to the States as an adult. "You're a botanist then," Sokoban said. The explorer sipped. His punch glass appeared far too small for his thick fingers. "In my experience, botanists tend to be university men, Mr. Sokoban. They prefer their plants dead and locked behind glass doors. My official title is agricultural explorer." Sokoban sensed he'd trespassed. He attempted to adjust his hat to no avail. He briefly considered excusing himself, but the smoke and the thought of facing the throngs kept him rooted at the window. "I assumed a degree would be necessary in your line of work." Meyer frowned slightly, as if tasting something sour. "I take it you completed university, Mr. Sokoban." "Yes, I take it you did not, Mr. Meyer." "I finished a single semester. Endured is perhaps a better word. The desks, sitting still, the other students. A man cannot hope to understand a species by memorizing Latin names or staring at a diagram in a textbook. A plant is not merely a thing, Mr. Sokoban. It is a living creature and must be experienced in its native habitat, observed, touched, even tasted." Meyer rocked on his heels. Suddenly, a smile spread across his face, revealing straight white teeth. For a moment, he appeared quite handsome. "More than anything," he said, "what is necessary in my line of work is a sturdy pair of shoes." Sokoban looked down. Beneath his cuffed trousers, the explorer was indeed wearing trail boots. Both men laughed, and whatever tension existed between them seemed to drift out the open window. The straw boater was sliding again, and Sokoban took it off, fanning himself. The open air felt cool against his face. "I confess that I have never stopped to consider that a plant might not be from the place where it grows." "Few do," Meyer said. "Take Holland's famous tulips, for instance. Everyone believes them to be Dutch or Irish potatoes that are anything but. They are transplants taken from one place and given new life in another. No different than you or me, Mr. Sokoban." Sokoban could hardly imagine anything in common with the burnished man next to him. They were standing close now in order to hear one another over the noise. Sokoban detected the faint smell of smoke from the explorer's shirt, not from cigarettes, but like charred wood from a campfire. The explorer intrigued him. Meyer was nearly a celebrity and not in some toshy sort of way. Sokoban wondered what sort of man would leave everything behind in order to strike out for the wilds. He was reminded of his brother Ethan, who sailed for South Africa the year before and was now flying supply planes there. Sokoban knew Ethan could have found similar work stateside, but his brother wouldn't hear of it. He was set on Africa. Sokoban suspected adventure wasn't enough to hold his brother. He needed real risk.
Well, I transported back into the book just now. That was really, really interesting. And do you think from a plotting standpoint that it was important that Sokoban had met Meyer?
Yes. All of this work, I mean, especially for me, I had spent many years trying to write a novel about Meyer. The novel that has come out is really my second attempt to write this novel. And it was important for me that Meyer appear with Sokoban and that they have this conversation, one in which we not only get a sense of who Meyer was, his personality, what drove him, right, his passion. And that conversation goes on, I should say, it's much longer than just that. But also that we make this connection in Sokoban's head between the adventurous, risk-taking Meyer and Sokoban's own younger brother, Ethan.
So one of the things that really struck me about Sokoban is that he seemed to have some sort of inner urge that was something that he could not overcome, even though it probably would have been wiser for him to do so, to not actually find out what actually happened, as opposed to just write the report with all the surface niceties that he initially encountered. And you think that is because he was searching for his brother?
Yeah, absolutely. I think in Sokoban's mind, these two cases get conflated. We also find out fairly early on in the novel, and this is true, that many people believe Meyer, because of his name, was Jewish. And Sokoban, I believe, based on other articles that he wrote, was Jewish. The chances of one Jew in rural China looking for another also enters into this. And I believe why it ups the stakes as well, that in Sokoban's head, who in my novel is very much a secularized and I would say even lapsed Jewish man, believes that this becomes in essence a spiritual quest as well. And that if he can do good work, that in his head on some level, something good will happen for his missing brother. I believe not as somebody who has experienced war, but in having read enough about it and having understood enough of the human condition, that these sorts of unspoken spiritual pacts were made in people's minds all the time. Mm-hmm. Here I am, stateside or not involved, my son, my husband, my brother, my whoever is off at war. If I am good, if I am good enough, if I am a good enough Christian, if I am a good enough, put in whatever religion you want, then my loved one will remain safe. And I believe that that is something that happens in Sokoban's head. So if he were just, again, a by the book, not obsessed, not driven, it makes, frankly, for a far less interesting story.
Yeah, driven by that inner urge was something much more interesting than just doing his job. But he was encountering his own anti-Semitism while he was doing it and had really gone to the point where he was asking for forgiveness instead of asking for permission, which I always think that's the best path anyway. So I kind of like that.
I think that everybody, I mean, when you talk about mysteries, I would say that every novel, and I've heard other writers say this, every novel in one way or another is a mystery. Mm-hmm. So there may be, in fact, a literal mystery or a case to be solved, but there is always the mystery of the main character, the focal character, the protagonist. There is always something that they are grappling with. And one of the mysteries is, are they going to come to some sort of peace? What is it that they are going to discover about themselves? And I think that that is certainly true of Sokoban. So while the premise of this book is the mystery, what has happened to this explorer, right? The book comes to really be a lot about Sokoban and his own inner turmoil.
Well, I will tell you that, you know, I practiced law for years before getting involved with food the way I am today. And I did some prosecution. And when you got a case, you had to actually put together and investigate. And it's a kind of plotting thing to do. And what I really liked about this book is that that plotting thing where sometimes nothing happens, it's a dead end, there's nothing to find, all of that came through. And unlike a lot of mysteries where everything leads to something else and you build the puzzle as you read it, this was much more like real life in the sense that not everything that you uncover is useful, maybe interesting, but not necessarily useful. And I really appreciated that, that it seemed very realistic to me in that way. And having to bribe people and all of that is just the way it is, you know. And so how much, I mean, I have so many questions to ask you. I want to know how much research you had to do and what life in China was like in those days. I also want you to talk a little bit more about Meyer and who he was and what he actually had accomplished through his life in terms of food. But let's go back to how much research you had to do on China.
A fair amount. So I sometimes people ask, you know, did you have to go over to China and so forth? I did not. I did not. This entire book was written from primary, secondary sources. There was a considerable amount of effort and research that I had to do. So in addition to various sources that I found online, and when I say that, they might be articles about Meyer, they might have been photographs that had been logged in some sort of archive, right? So I was looking at his photographs. Sometimes I would come across documents, PDFs of letters that he had written. I read several books, one of which was the biography that was written by Isabel Shipley Cunningham, out of print. So I, you know, ordered a used copy, got one of the last kind of copies in circulation. It was a Bible for me, and really the only book-length work that had ever been written about Meyer and his explorations. I read about Meyer's supervisor at Foreign Seed and Plant Introduction, the man who began that office, David Fairchild, who also did a fair amount of exploration himself and was Meyer's supervisor at the time that Meyer went missing. In addition to that, I did go to the National Agricultural Library in Maryland and then the National Archives. And I looked at, I want to just say this, every American, I wish you to go to the National Archives. What a tremendous experience. So I spent several days at the National Archives looking at both transcripts of letters from that time that Meyer had written, letters to Meyer, but also again, photographs, and then some primary sources. So I was able to hold in my hand, you know, notes, memos. There was a time at which Meyer had a real down emotional moment the year before he went missing. He had, in essence, a nervous breakdown and wrote a proposed draft of his resignation. Because he was running low on paper, he wrote this on used envelopes. took them in the field. You know, he didn't have a lot of supplies in the field, unpeeled the envelopes and used it as writing papers. So I was able to hold those envelopes and in my hand. It was really quite moving for me. So in answer to your question, a lot of different research. In the end, it felt as though there was almost too much. What became difficult, Liz, to find was actually material from that time, right? In the form of either photographs or documents. And I think that is because so much of that material has disappeared in consequent Chinese revolutions, you know, violence and so forth. For many, many years, you would not have wanted to acknowledge any sort of imperialist or American connection. So much of the material that continues to exist from that era is because foreigners went to China and then returned, and it's their documents that have survived. That was really kind of priceless, useful information, even finding something like a photograph from the Yangtze River at that time. If I were to go to China now, the China that existed in 1918 would be probably unrecognizable. Some of the places that are mentioned in the book are now been flooded by the Three Gorges Dam. Right? They no longer exist. Literally, they're gone. The form of government no longer exists. The national culture is so very changed. So in my own sort of, I don't know, nod to method acting almost, I really limited my research to that time and tried my very best not to read beyond it. I did not want to be influenced by that. I really wanted to be immersed and mine every photograph, every letter I could for authentic details that would help me. Mm-hmm. Even though, and I want to say this, but might help in kind of understanding the level of imagination that you have to use. Yes, that is absolutely there. You have to take some wild flights and give yourself permission. But one thing that was very helpful for me as a New Orleanian was that Meyer goes missing from a hot, humid climate with a major river that is often used for navigation and trade and sometimes floods. And I thought, wow, hot, sultry, humid weather, a major river of navigation that's never quite blue and is often blue-brown, right? And has a long history of trade. Where have I seen this before? Right. So having the Mississippi and having our particular latitude, our weather, our humidity, I really tapped into that for writing and connecting with the landscape.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you definitely made it seem very real. So that was, I never thought, oh, this is ridiculous. No, it always felt like, yes, this is the way it would be. Yes, you would sweat all day. Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Well, Allison, this has been a delightful conversation. I really like the book. It's really wonderful. Would you tell us a little bit about where a person can get this book?
Absolutely. So the book is going to be officially launched on June 4, which means that, you know, it will appear in the world in physical copy. You can pre-order the book on any number of sites. If you type in Foreign Sea by Allison Alsup, you will find it on the major outlets where you can purchase book, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. I also want to highly encourage people to order copies from our independent and local bookstores. The launch of the book is set for June 5. Right. So the day after the book is released, and it will be at Octavia Books at 6 p.m.
Octavia Books in New Orleans.
Octavia Books in New Orleans at 6 p.m. So we're going to have a presentation then, and I'll be in conversation with Elisa Speranza, who is another local writer. And also her book, The Italian Prisoner, is also historical fiction set here in New Orleans. So I'm very excited about that.
And we'll be drinking lemonade made with Meyer lemons at the event.
To be determined, but I guarantee that there will be either in a food or liquid form some nod to lemons. You know, the Meyer lemon, which we haven't talked about, and maybe I should.
Sure.
Well, I'm just wondering, you know, maybe people will have heard of Meyer if they've heard his name is because of the Meyer lemon. And there is an irony here because Meyer wrote specifically to his office saying, I do not wish for anything to be named after me. And the Meyer lemon is only called the Meyer lemon because Meyer's supervisor, David Fairchild, insisted on calling this lemon after Meyer.
And that was because he was gone and he was missing.
He was gone. It was done in his absence. It was done in his absence. Yes. And I think that if Meyer were alive today, he would be quite surprised that of all of his finds, all of his introductions, that this is the one that he, if people even put together the idea that this is named after a person who went to a foreign country and plucked, right, this species and then shipped it across an ocean to be officially introduced to the United States. That lemon was found outside of Peking, as many things, most of the things that Meyer found along his walks. And he would come across a plant, know that it was not yet introduced, right? He had an almost encyclopedic memory of plant species. And he would go up to it and decide whether or not it could be something that would be useful for Americans. And that was something that was particular to his line of work for foreign seed and plant introduction. That was their mission from that office, was to find useful species for the American public. Many of those things were edibles. Many of those things were things that people could eat. But in some cases, they would support the agriculture that would help people to either grow or ranch. So in other words, many crops were introduced from foreign seed that people eat. This might be certain types of fruits. This might be certain types of vegetables. But in addition to that, things that might be forage crops like alfalfa or barley. And these would be species that would often be attractive for the men who were exploring on behalf of the American government, because they might be things that were drought resistant, or they might be able to be frost resistant. They were looking all the time for hardy, resilient species. This was at a time when our country was still expanding in terms of its agriculture. And the mission was really, how can we feed the nation? How can we help American farmers? How can we also encourage them to settle in areas that until this time have been considered, the conditions were considered too hostile, too difficult to have agriculture in? So that is their really strong connection to, you know, feeding the people, expanding American agriculture. And really, this was their mission of, this was how they were going to help to literally grow America, keep it strong.
That's really interesting. Well, thanks so much, Allison. This has been a great talk.
Thank you so much. It's been a thrill, a hoot, and a holler.
Thanks for listening to Tip of the Tongue, a part of the Nitty Grits Network of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Subscribe to this and other food and drink-related podcasts at southernfood.org or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you want to keep up with me, Liz Williams, you can subscribe to my Substack newsletter, also called Tip of the Tongue, for more information about this podcast, recipes, and just what is going on. I'm Liz Williams. Thanks for listening.